Hi, this is Tom Robbins.
And Jennifer Nichols.
And today we're talking about how we are dealing with grief. Thanks for being with us. Stick with us. Welcome back. We appreciate you all joining us through this process. It's a weird fucking process for sure. So of course Jennifer is back with us, and you know, thanks for joining us, and thanks for joining me, Jennifer. So we're going to jump right into it. So the last thing he said to you was, am I dying?
That's right. He looked at me and said, am I dying? And I said, are you ready? You're not ready to die yet, are you? And he said, no, I'm not. I said, well, we're going to do everything we can. So he, well, I'm not ready to say goodbye. And right after that, he was in the hospital bed. There was almost always a nurse in the room. The nurse was in there. We were just getting him back in the bed from being in a chair, a recliner, one of those fancy ones, you know. And his blood pressure bottomed out, and we barely had him in the bed. Like, he passed out because his blood pressure just crashed.
Wow.
You know, it's really kind of blurry exactly what happened after that. He coded twice in a row. I feel like I'm missing a piece there. You know, grief is a funny thing. Your brain protects you from too much trauma, I think. I feel like I'm missing a piece because I feel like I was in one room when he said that, and then when he coded, he was in a different room. Maybe they did a procedure in between. I don't remember. My sister and all might remember. I don't know.
It's okay. It's not a very important piece.
It's really not. So we were in the, my sister-in-law and I were in the room when he coded. And with those big hospitals, when you see that, what do they call that code? Is it red, blue? I don't remember. That code team comes in the room. That room is full. And there is one doctor running that code at the foot of the bed, and there's somebody at the head of the bed intubating. The nurse was on top of my husband, straddling him, doing CPR, and there was at least 15 people in that room, and we couldn't get out of the room.
The trauma team.
Because there were so many people in the room, we couldn't get out. We were crammed back in the corner up by the head of the bed. Unbeknownst to anyone, maybe one or two of my really close friends, for whatever reason, I turned the video on my phone. So I have that.
Wow.
On my phone.
Do you go back and watch it?
I've watched it a couple times, but it's been a long time.
Yeah.
So it's just a lot of chaos. It's very controlled chaos.
Yeah, but how do you feel when you watch it?
It's been long. I don't know. I'm not trying to be flip. I don't know how I feel, because in the moment it was unbelievable that was happening.
Yeah.
And I know, because the video doesn't show much of him. It just, you can hear all the noise, because I'm not like holding it up like you would normally. I just turned it on because I thought, I wonder what's going to happen. This is it. This is the end. And I was afraid I wouldn't be able to remember it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I don't know how all that happened. So I have that on my phone. And we were backed into the corner, and they were running the code, and so much equipment and stuff they brought in, like, I, for whatever reason, don't read too much into this. I still have the same purse that I had that day. And yeah, it's been 2 years ago, but I'm not that girl that changes purses every time you turn around. Right. When I find what I like, I carry it until it falls apart, right? At that point, it was a brand new purse. Well, when all the equipment and everybody came in the room, it was sitting on the floor back on the other side of the room, and there was a cup of coffee over there and it got spilled on it. The coffee stain's still on it. I've tried to wash it. It's still there. I'm like, so every time I look at my purse, I see this coffee stain. It takes me back to that minute.
Yeah.
I'm like, I should really get a new purse. I'm like, I like this purse. I don't want a different purse.
So,
isn't that crazy? Is that crazy?
Why does it have to be crazy?
It doesn't have to be crazy.
You're right, it doesn't.
Okay.
So what's it matter? You like the purse, you're keeping it. Okay, moving on.
Okay.
What you could do is buy the same purse without the coffee stain.
I could, but if you know much about women's stuff, you can't seldom find the same product.
I know nothing about women's stuff.
There you go. I'm sure I can find something else that I like just as well. I just haven't done it. It's just one of those things that it just didn't matter. Anyway, so he coded. We were backed into the corner. My sister-in-law was behind me. She was crying, if I remember right. I was not, which seems strange to me that I was not crying, but I don't think I was.
I don't think so. I think that's a
trauma response.
I would say you're in a state of shock, like, holy shit, what's really going on?
That you know
what
be I mean? It.
Like, it's really hard to process, especially something like that significant. You know, it's not like you were just processing a problem. Like, you were processing a huge life event.
Yes. So eventually, I don't know how long, it seemed like a long time. And there were so many people in the room, and it was chaotic, but it was very controlled. The doctor running the code was, the doctors there were awesome. Okay, you know, you hear people say, oh, well, they didn't do that. No, they did everything they possibly could.
Well, it's like a symphony, right? Like,
yeah.
They've got to be able to make everything do exactly what they're supposed
to
do.
Exactly, and everybody in that room had a job, and if they weren't being told to do something, they didn't move and they didn't speak. Only the ones that were doing things were the ones moving and speaking. Anyway, and I was right by the head of the bed when all that was happening.
Right, so where was the doctor? At the foot of the bed?
There was a doctor at the foot of the bed, and the nurse practitioner was at the head of the bed intubating him. And the nurse, the RN, was on top of him.
Pumping.
So, and there was another nurse, and they had to trade off because you can only do that for a few minutes.
Yeah,
so they traded twice.
It's exhausting.
They traded twice, I think, by the time somebody finally, I don't want to say finally, somebody weaved their way to me and Annette and reached their hand out to me and said, come on, come with me.
Yeah, let's get and you out of here.
I didn't want to leave. It was like I wanted to see what happened.
Yeah.
But
they didn't want you to see.
They didn't want me in there.
Well, right. Like, how, again, like, you know, especially from a health professional's standpoint, like, it's bad enough that they, you know, that they have to deal with that stuff. Obviously, they get paid to do it. I'm going to tell you, my wife comes home from work, and there are some days where she cries.
Oh, wow, but I can't imagine.
It's like, cool, like, come here, I'll give you a hug, right? Like, just, you're home.
My middle daughter's a nurse. She's not a nurse in a hospital, but she's in long-term care, and I'm just like, I don't know how you are still doing this.
Yeah.
And it's like, anyway, they were all very, very good at what they did. So they pulled us out of the room and made us go sit in the waiting area that's more of a private, it wasn't private, it was the one in the middle of the unit and had glass walls. And I think it had a sign on the door that said something about, don't be in here unless you're supposed to be in here. If there's family in here, don't come in or whatever.
Yeah.
Anyway, so we were sitting in there, and one of his numerous doctors came and talked to me and said, so, you know, his heart's failing, it's not pumping, and we're going to put him on ECMO. to keep him alive while we're trying to navigate getting him a LVAD, which is a left ventricular assist device. It's a heart pump that you wear with batteries 24/7, where you're plugged into the wall. And I'm like, oh, what? Like, I don't know anything about any of this.
Yeah.
Like, not a clue, not zero, like nothing. And I'm like, how is that gonna work? And I'm thinking about, how is he gonna be able to function like that? Like, how is that gonna work? And she said, and she saw that concern on my face. She says, oh, don't worry, we have patients, they do great on this. And I'm like, really?
Yeah, because you don't know what you don't know.
Well, could you imagine hearing a pump in your body 24/7?
No.
I can't either. Like, I don't know. I guess maybe you get used to it and you eventually block it out. I don't really know how that works.
It's probably like my the fire alarms in my, or smoke detectors in my house. I haven't changed batteries.
Oh, Tom.
And so anytime, I was talking to my wife yesterday and I heard a beep and I was like, oh, I gotta remember to change those batteries. And then I get home and I think when I walk through the door, I just don't listen to it.
Yeah, maybe so. So she came and talked to us about that. They didn't let us back in the room yet. I had already numerous times broken hospital rules and went places I was not supposed to go. You weren't allowed to hang around. You weren't allowed to be in the hallways there. You could walk through the hallway to get to a room, but you could not stand in the hallway unless you were talking with a doctor. They didn't allow that, with good reason. And they also did not allow visitors to be in the rooms all night and sleep. If you were in the room and you wanted to be there all night, you had to be awake. You could not sleep in the rooms.
Yeah, I'm sure they break that probably pretty often.
No. The first couple nights, the first time we were there and that time when we were there, no. They were very specific about, if you're going to be in here, you have to be awake. I'm like, okay, I'll be awake. So I was awake for many, many, many hours. I was sitting in just a, like, not a recliner chair. Oftentimes that's just one of those, you know, like a, just a regular, just a chair, just mm-hmm. like a doctor's office waiting room chair.
Yeah.
Sitting. Did I doze? Probably. Did I sleep? No. Anyway, so, we were in that waiting area and I couldn't sit in there any longer. And so I went out and went down the back hallway through where the nurses and aides and stuff usually were, and they're, you know, they have their little office spaces back there and everything, and cut through back to see if I could see what was going on, and one of the doctors caught me. And as I was standing there watching them all still in the room working on him, like, most of the team had left. They had to call another code. He coded twice while they were in the middle of trying to get the ECMO hooked up to him.
Damn.
So ECMO, you know, we hear that word and we're like, oh, well, that's a cool thing. It saves your life. It is very traumatic to your body. It basically keeps your blood moving, but it totally tears up your organs while it's doing it. Because your body's been through so much trauma already, and then you've got an artificial pump pumping the blood and oxygenating the blood and filtering the blood through your body because your heart can't do it. And it's very seeing that is something. I'm not sure how to describe that. Anyway, they got him all set up on that, put in a different kind of heart pump. I wanna say it was a, yeah, I'm not gonna come up with it right now. Anyway, so many days of ECMO on, ECMO off. We gotta switch this one from his neck to his groin. This thing is happening where the blood is trying to go backwards because the right side of his heart is working, the left side is not. So now we gotta switch this around. We gotta take this one out of his neck and put it in his groin. And I know one night in particular, I was sitting in the room. It was a bay with several beds because there was so much equipment around him that they wouldn't fit in a regular room. Mm-hmm. And not that the regular rooms, they were very small. They were tiny.
Right.
And the doctors were in there for hours trying to get things straightened out. And they finally did. And it seemed like they were like, yep, I think we got it going. And his brain function is still good. And he would still, like, if I held his hand, I could tell that he knew I was there. Like, he'd move his hand a little bit. And the whole process of that, ECMO, and your body retains fluids. Like, he swelled up great big everywhere. It was awful. Because the kidneys don't work right and you have to have dialysis. During all of that, also, at one point, they said, something strange is going on with his lungs. We don't really know what it is, but now we're going to do this lung scope every day until we get that cleared up.
Oh, great.
Okay, so I'm not saying that this was before they named and knew the signs for COVID, before it was public knowledge, but he was not the only one that was having this. The waiting room that we had to wait in when we were on that unit, there were a lot of people, or there were several other women there with husbands that had been in there, and they were having the same issue. Was it COVID? Maybe. It doesn't matter at this point.
Right.
I mean, it really doesn't. I'm going to say it was, just on top of all the other things. And so, after many, many days and switching the ECMO around, and every day was a roller coaster, and I mean every day was up and down and up and down. And there was one particular doctor, I was so thankful to have met him. He would take the time to talk with me and really explain things so I could understand it, because I don't know anything about, I know a little bit now, but I didn't know anything about the biology of our hearts and how all that works and what are our choices and what's this going to look like, and then how is it going to be, what is his life going to be like, and what do we have to do to get on the transplant list, because he wasn't eligible at that point because his blood sugar was out of control.
And he was a smoker.
He used a dipper. So, you know, how long can he be on this LVAD while we're waiting? Because this, you know, getting his blood sugar under control seems like that's going to be a big challenge. And anyway, and this whole time, Eddie's out. They're keeping him out. They're keeping him sedated,
yeah,
just enough to keep him just under. If I was in the room, and we could really only go in one at a time because there literally was not room for more than one other person besides the nurse that was in the room all the time. Okay? So, you couldn't, very seldom was there a chair to even sit in. So it was in and out, stand there as long as I could, and then leave. Well, in the meantime, I got sick. I'm 100% sure it was COVID. It was before it was named COVID.
Yeah.
I'd been to the urgent care. They said, no, it's not the flu. I could not breathe. I could not walk when it came on. I had a fever. I was okay. I was a little tired. Of course, we weren't sleeping well. I had a fever of 105. Like, I was fine, and then all of a sudden, fever of 105. Could not breathe. Couldn't get enough breath to have a conversation. The walk to the room was so long, I would have to stop numerous times to get from the parking garage to his room. They were stopping everybody at security when he walked in because they were saying flu season, flu season, flu season.
Yeah.
Which really, I think it was.
They knew.
They knew, but they
just
weren't
saying.
Wasn't
public knowledge, yeah.
Right, and we didn't know. And so the nurses knew I was not feeling great, but I didn't really let on just how terrible I felt. But they were the ones that said, well, you need to go get a flu test just to be sure. I'm like, okay. So, no, it wasn't the flu. They said, you have viral bronchitis. I said, really? I've had bronchitis many, many times. This is nothing like bronchitis. This is the worst thing ever. I've even had pneumonia before, and it was worse than that. So, anyway, that's beside the point. We went through this whole process. We met with the LVAD team because we were getting ready to, because somebody has to agree to be with that person 24/7. Because in that process, learning how to manage the batteries and the pump and the medications that go with it, sometimes the patient is not capable of doing something that needs to be done, right? Like, your blood has to be a certain, like, we were just getting into it. I really don't know a whole lot, okay? There has to be somebody available to turn off the alarm and do whatever needs to be done if the patient can't do it.
Sure.
Okay. So we met with the head of the LVAD team. We met lovely man that came and talked with us who had an LVAD, and he was doing pretty good. Like, you could tell he was a little bit, you know, tired and sick, but he was all right. He was doing okay. I had my sister-in-law was there, and Eddie's aunt and uncle were there, and we were all feeling pretty hopeful. The doctors came in and said, hey, we're taking this ECMO, this one off, in the morning, first thing in the morning, and we're going to start waking him up again, because all the time he's still on the vent. And I'm like, great, awesome. So we go back that night, we go back to the place we were staying, and went to bed and went to sleep thinking, okay,
yeah,
we have a plan. And it's trying to decide if she's going to go home and go back to work, and I'm trying to figure out how to manage the house from 2 hours away and the dogs. And so my phone rang at 2:30 in the morning, and it was the hospital, and it was his nurse. She said, I have to call you because I'm calling you because there's been a change with your husband's status. And I said, what do you mean? She said, well, how did she say that? I noticed his, they check every, it's like,
yeah,
every 30 minutes, every 15
vitals.
Minutes.
Yeah.
It gets very often. I noticed when I checked his vitals, his eyes weren't dilating like they're supposed to. So we had the CT scanner come up to do a CT scan, and the results were inconclusive, but we think he's had a brain bleed. And I'm like, okay. She said, well, sometimes these resolve themselves and sometimes they don't. Okay, so I'm thinking, okay, so one more thing. Like, I hadn't gotten a phone call in the middle of the night. Like, I usually called him right before I went to sleep, and I called him if I woke up in the middle of the night, but they had never called me.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay, all right. I'm like, well, do I need to come now? She said, no, no. Everything else is still the same as it was. Just that has changed, but I had to tell you. I'm like, okay. So we go first thing in the morning, and which is a little earlier than we normally went. And they tried to get the CT scanner back up there again, and the mobile one wasn't working right. To move him took, I want to say, 8 to 10 people. I can't remember because somebody had to drive the bed, somebody had to be on the heart pump, somebody had to be on the ECMO, somebody had to be on the ventilator. It was a whole process to move him to,
yeah,
where the CT scanner is. So we watched him, and when I saw him, I thought, he's gone. He's already almost gone. He wasn't responding to me. He wouldn't squeeze my hand. His eyes were doing something weird. So then the doctor came and showed me the scans from the night before and then the ones they did that morning, and he had massive strokes front, back, and in the front and in the back and somewhere else, like down by the neck, somewhere down by your spine. So basically, and then his brain waves were, so basically he was, he wasn't brain dead, but he wasn't right. He was never going to be right. So oftentimes when you're on blood thinners, like he had to be on the blood thinners for the heart pumps to work and the ECMO to work, that's when you have a stroke because you're thinning your blood.
Yeah.
Right? So to be on an LVAD, you have to be on blood thinners. When you have a stroke, you cannot be on blood thinners.
Right.
So there you are.
So
his body was still alive because he was, they did take out the ECMO, they took it all out, I think, because they had him on a external heart pump at that point, and it has a Centromag, I think is the name of it. They took the ECMO out, had him on a Centromag, so he looked better because he didn't have these two big garden hose sized tubes coming out of his neck with blood running through him.
Right.
Right? Looked better that way, but then his eyes were not, he was not, it was not good.
Well, I mean, after multiple strokes, you would assume that.
Yeah. So, yeah. So the doctor said, so he can't have an LVAD unless he can be on blood thinners. You can't be on blood thinners when you have a stroke. Three massive strokes. So I had to tell them to unhook everything so he could die. Because what else are you going
to
do?
That's a hard decision to...
After all that, after all those days of hope every day, okay, is he going to be okay? Are we going to be able to have a life together for a while longer? Are we going to be able to... And then to come down to the day they're taking the ECMO off. And that's the day.
Yeah.
It was hard. It was hard. It was hard to be there. His aunt and uncle came, my daughter and son-in-law came, my sister-in-law, of course, was there. And we just played by music and just sat with him till he passed.
How long did that take?
You know, I'm not exactly sure. It felt like it took a really long time.
Yeah.
Part of the reason that you don't think about, so he had this heart pump on the outside of him pumping his blood. Okay, so it's probably 6 or 8 feet of tubing still running through a machine. That's a lot of blood to be on the outside of your body. Well, when they turn all that off, then his heart that's failing, that's why we have the heart pump running, which is now no longer running.
Yeah.
You'd think it would just be a minute or two. You're a couple minutes. I honestly don't remember how long it was, but it felt like it was about 20 minutes or 30 minutes. I could not believe it took that long. And maybe it wasn't that long. I really don't know. Wow. Like, I would have to go back and try to check it. And our lovely medical system, like, as soon as he died, I couldn't get into his medical records. Like, that fast.
Wow.
Yeah. Hmm. So, I don't know how long it took. Honestly, I don't know. It felt like it took 20 or 30 minutes, which is crazy to me because I had him extubating because I didn't want that in there. I didn't want him to have to die with that in his mouth because he hated that.
Yeah.
He hated that. He did not want that at all when he went for that stent. He didn't want that, but that's the way they do that. So, anyway, or that's the way I had to do it for him. I can't speak for other how that works out. So, anyway, so that was very traumatic. We went back to the little room, the little dark waiting room. After that, they left me in there alone with him for a few minutes. And I walked back to that waiting room, and I know it was quite a little ways of a long walk, and I'm telling you, I still was sick. I was still sick. I wasn't running a fever at that point, but I still couldn't breathe.
Yeah.
And my daughter, God love her, had to take care of everything. I couldn't do anything. Like, everything you have to take care of with the nurse when all that happens, I don't even know what it is because I couldn't do it. Like, you have to tell them things, and you have to fill out a questionnaire for the death certificate, and... on the questionnaire for the death certificate, part one of the questions is occupation. So Eddie had been working as a van driver. If you remember, he'd gotten hurt, so he had not been working. And so prior to that, he had been in retail management for many years. We owned a store, and then he worked in management for a small chain, and always wheeling and dealing stuff. And I'm so glad that my kids have a sense of humor, even in the midst of grief. And it seems like we get even crazier and dark when grief hits.
Yeah.
For the questionnaire, said occupation, she filled in shit shooter. Wow. And I said, that's perfect. That's exactly right. And so they didn't allow that. They called back at some point and said, you can't. That doesn't work. We can't put that on there.
Right. Yes, you can.
No, you can't. Anyway, so we got back to the little room, and it was time to leave. And I couldn't get up. Couldn't get out of the chair.
Hmm.
Shock.
Yeah.
And exhaustion, absolute exhaustion. I'd spent as much time as I could that day in a room with him, standing by the bed.
Well, and you talk all about the cumulative time,
leading
up to that, right? Like, you're running off
of... Maybe sleeping 3 hours a night. And
running off of adrenaline and what the hell's going
to
happen.
So I couldn't get up. So then they had to take me down to the ER.
And they're like, here, take this.
Here, take this, exactly. Here, take this, you'll feel better. So I did.
What was it?
Klonopin.
Oh, shit.
Right?
Here, take this. I don't really want to.
I didn't want to. I didn't want to take it. They were like, no, you need to take this. You're going to be okay. Because they ran a bunch of tests because, of course, they thought that I was having a heart attack.
Right.
Which I was not. My heart is fine.
You probably weren't too far from it, though. Like... I say that only because it's a lot to take
it
in.
It is. You know? It is a lot. And that's why they wanted me to take the Klonopin. So yeah. I took the Klonopin. Jessica got me, my oldest daughter got me and my sister-in-law back to the house where we were staying. And we all went to bed. And then things got really crazy the next morning. Still crazy.
Yeah. I think that is a great place to... hold off until next time. So, thanks for joining us.
Yeah.
We'll be back.
Thanks for listening.
Yeah. What are you going through? Send us a message.